paths somewhere out west. He looked at the brooding face and the boxer's physique and thought, maybe. He offered his hand. Pollard took it. Smith smiled. He gestured toward the stall behind him. Pollard leaned over Seabiscuit's half door. The horse had his back to him, a dark mass shifting in the straw. Pollard pushed his hand into his pocket and pulled it out again with his fingers closed. He extended his arm and opened his hand. The cube of sugar. From the back of the stall there came a tentative sound of nostrils drawing the air, weighing the scent. A black muzzle materialized, licked up the sugar, and touched the jockey's shoulder. The scattered lives of Red Pollard, Tom Smith, and Charles Howard had come to an intersection. Their crowded hour had begun. Part 2 Chapter 7 Learn Your Horse. The grooms were walking around with their faces fixed in permanent winces. Every time they passed Seabiscuit's stall, the horse lunged at them, mouth wide open, ears flat back, eyes in a sinister pinch, and he meant business. Heaven help the poor kid who had to go in there, muck the floor, and curry the horse. Everyone was wondering what Smith possibly could have been thinking. The horse was a train wreck. He paced in his stall incessantly. He broke into a lather at the sight of a saddle. He was 200 pounds underweight and chronically tired. He was so thin, said one observer, that his hips could have made a passable hat rack. But he refused to eat. And that left foreleg didn't look good. As he did with every new horse, Smith pored over Seabiscuit when he was with him and mulled him over when he was not. The first thing he had to try to do, the trainer decided, was defuse the horse. Ignoring the snapping jaws and pinned ears, he showered him with affection and carrots. He then tried one of the oldest remedies for unhappy horses, animal companionship. Motley collections of stray animals have always populated racetracks, and being the social creatures they are, horses usually befriend them. All sorts of animals, from German shepherds to chickens, have become the stable companions of racehorses. A three-legged cat lived with Fitzsimmons' horses. The trainer dismantled a piece of harness and crafted a tiny wooden leg for him, then watched as the cat learned to snare mice with one paw and blackjack them with the other. At a track in Arizona, a monkey was a popular mascot, until he began turning on all the shed row faucets and tearing the shingles off the roof. Smith took the goat route. He dug up a nanny named Whiskers and parked her in Seabiscuit's stall. Shortly after dinner time, the grooms found Seabiscuit walking in circles, clutching the distraught goat in his teeth and shaking her back and forth. He heaved her over his half door and plopped her down in the barn aisle. The grooms ran to her rescue. Smith opted for a companion who could take a little more punishment. Down the shed row, he kept a lead horse he called Pumpkin. As broad as a Sherman tank and yellow as a daisy, Pumpkin, or Punkins, as the hands called him, had once been a Montana cow pony. Out on the range, the horse had experienced everything, including a bull goring that had left a gouge in his rump. He was a veteran, meeting every calamity with a cheerful steadiness. He was, in the parlance of horsemen, bomb-proof. Smith recognized the value of a horse like this and brought him along with his racing string to work as a lead pony, Smith's track mount, and general stable calmer downer. Pumpkin was amiable to every horse he met and became a surrogate parent to the flighty ones. He worked a sedative effect on the whole barn. After Seabiscuit evicted the goat, Smith hauled in Pumpkin. A brief mutual nose-sniffing produced no ill will, so Smith decided to make Seabiscuit Pumpkin's new assignment. He housed Pumpkin in one stall, Seabiscuit in the next, and tore down the wall between. The horses conversed and developed a fast friendship. They would live and work together for the rest of their lives. The experiment with Pumpkin worked so well that Smith began collecting other stable companions for Seabiscuit. Somewhere along the way, a little spotted stray dog, fell in with the Howard barn and began to travel with it. Named Pocatel, the dog had curiously upright ears that were round as platters and roughly three times normal size. Pocatel took a liking to Seabiscuit and began sleeping in a stall at night. Jojo, a small spider monkey of undetermined origin, had the same preference for Seabiscuit's company. Sleeping with Pumpkin a few feet away, Jojo in the crook of his neck and Pocatel on his belly, Seabiscuit began to relax. The next hurdle was the horse's sore and underweight body. Smith mixed up a homemade liniment and painted it on Seabiscuit's legs. To keep the mixture from rubbing off when the horse lay in his straw, and to protect his dinged-up legs from additional bumps and bruises, the trainer instituted a routine of keeping the horse in knee-high, inches-thick cotton bandages, once compared to World War I puttees. Smith also paid very close attention to Seabiscuit's fuel. He fed the colt a high-quality strain of Timothy hay, cultivated in Northern California, which he had come across during his first days as a trainer. For oats, he ladled out carefully measured portions of a fine white variety grown in the Sacramento Valley. After reading an article describing the nutritional intake of the University of Washington crew team, Smith made sure the horse received feed with a high calcium content. For bedding, he spread out a thick mattress of dust-free rice straw. Once Seabiscuit had settled in at Detroit, Smith took the colt to the track to stretch his legs. It was a disaster. Seabiscuit didn't run. He rampaged. When the rider asked him for speed, the horse slowed down. When he tried to rein him in, the horse bolted, thrashing around like a hooked marlin. Asked to go left, he'd dodge right. Tugged right, he'd dart left. The beleaguered rider could do no better than cling to the horse's neck for dear life. Smith watched, his eyes following the colt as he careened across the track, running as a moth flies. Smith knew what he was seeing. Seabiscuit's competitive instincts had been turned backward. Instead of directing his efforts against his opponents, he was directing them against the handlers who tried to force him to run. He habitually met every command with resistance. He was feeding off the fight, gaining satisfaction from the distress and rage of the man on his back. Smith knew how to stop it. He had to take coercion out of the equation and let the horse discover the pleasure of speed. He called out to the rider, "Let him go!" The rider did as told, and Seabiscuit took off with him, trying once to hurdle the infield fence, but meeting with no resistance from the reins. He made a complete circuit at top speed, but Smith issued no orders to stop him, so around he went again, dipping and swerving. After galloping all out for 2 miles, weaving all over the track, Seabiscuit was exhausted. He stopped himself and stood on the track, panting. The rider simply sat there, letting him choose what to do. There was nowhere to go but home. Seabiscuit turned and walked back to the barn of his own volition. Smith greeted him with a carrot. Neither Smith nor his exercise rider had raised a hand to him, but the colt had learned the lesson that would transform him from a rogue to a pliant, happy horse. He would never again be forced to do what he didn't want to do. He never again fought a rider. After that wild ride, Smith put Pollard up on Seabiscuit for the first time to see how he would handle the horse. Pollard rode the horse around, studying him. Seabiscuit wouldn't try much for him. Pollard turned him and brought him back to the barn. Trainer and jockey conferred. Pollard told Smith that the whip, used so liberally by Fitzsimmons, had to be put away. It should be used, he said, only in times of great urgency. Pollard saw that if this horse was pushed around, all he would do was push back. Smith knew he had found the right jockey. Smith and Pollard made a point of allowing Seabiscuit to do as he pleased. Smith issued orders that the horse never be disturbed while sleeping for any reason. Riders and grooms would sometimes stand around for hours waiting for the horse to wake up before they could get to work. Seabiscuit milked it for all it was worth. "He wakes up in the morning like a sly old codger," said Pollard. "You know, the biscuit is like an old gentleman, and he hates to get up with the rising sun." When you go to his stall, he lays over like a limp old rag and peeks out at you with one eye to see whether you get what he's trying to drive over, that he's sick as a dog. He'd get away with it if he could, but wise old Tom Smith knows him like a book. Pollard and the other exercise riders were given instructions to simply lean on his neck, sitting still, and leaving the reins loose so that the horse could choose his own pace. By making sure that all workouts ended at the finish line, Smith taught Seabiscuit that he needed to be ahead of other horses by the time he crossed the wire. Racetracks are ringed with poles that tell riders what fraction of a mile remains before the finish wire. Pollard found that with every pole he passed, the horse would run harder. Pollard didn't need to hold him back or rate him in the early part of workouts. The horse knew that the home stretch was where the real running was done. "Why rate him?" Pollard would later say. "He knows the poles better than I do." Over the next weeks, Pollard and Smith discovered that obstreperousness was only one of Seabiscuit's bad traits. He amused himself by propping in mid-workout, decelerating rapidly and vaulting his jockey up onto his neck. He also harbored a peculiar ardor for the inner rail. He refused to run at all unless he was practically on top of it. A consequence, Smith believed, of Fitzsimmons' practice of invariably working the horse along the inside. When he was guided away from the rail, Seabiscuit would slow down and do just about anything to get back over to it, including abruptly ducking inside. This created two problems. First, the area by the inner rail was the lowest part of the slightly banked oval, so it tended to hold the most water, making it the slowest, most tiring part of the track during and after rainstorms. Second, he was most likely to get caught in traffic jams on the rail. Any horse who refused to swing wide could get into serious trouble. Hoping to focus the horse's mind on his job and reduce the distractions of the rail, Smith fitted Seabiscuit with a set of blinkers that restricted his vision to the track straight ahead of him. He took the horse out to gallop on a morning when track officials, trying to protect the overused inside of the course, had put out dogs, sawhorses lining the rail path to keep exercising horses to the outside. By galloping the horse to the outside of the dogs, Smith hoped to wean him from the rail. Seabiscuit thwarted his efforts, ducking into the rail in the gaps between dogs, swerving out to avoid them, then cutting in again. Smith kept at it, eventually making progress. Unable to eliminate the rail obsession completely, the trainer made use of it. As Seabiscuit was apt to fight any direct attempts to rate him, Smith told his riders to adjust the horse's speed with steering. When a rider wanted Seabiscuit to speed up, he would swing him toward the rail. When he wanted him to ease off, he'd nudge him to the outside. The most difficult quirk was Seabiscuit's behavior in the starting gate. Within its metal confines, he raised holy hell, throwing himself around, exhausting the assistant starters, and reminding everyone of hardtack. To stop the colt's gate rages, Smith used a daring method. He led him out to the gate each morning, walked him inside it, and asked him to halt. Risking life and limb, Smith positioned himself directly in front of the horse, facing him. When Seabiscuit began banging around to get out, Smith held his ground, raised his hand, and tapped the horse firmly on the chest and shoulders until he stood still. When the horse stopped, so did Smith. When the horse moved, Smith tapped him again. Morning after morning, he was out at the gate with the horse, repeating the lesson. "You gotta go at a horse slowly, teaching him most anything," Smith explained later. "Easy, firm repetition does it." The effect was mesmerizing. The horse began to relax in the gate. "He caught on quick enough," said Smith. "He's wise as an old owl." Eventually, Smith was able to leave Seabiscuit standing in there for as long as 10 minutes without the horse turning a hair. Smith also made a point of giving Seabiscuit a structured life. The horse got breakfast when he woke up, usually at 4:30, followed by stall mucking and grooming at 5, and a lengthy gallop with Pumpkin at 8. For horses, downshifting from strenuous exercise is risky. If they are brought to idleness too soon after running all out, in old cowboy parlance, being rid hard and put away wet, their major muscle groups can seize up in an agonizing spasm called tying up. In addition, they can develop colic, a potentially fatal digestive crisis. Because of this, horses must be brought down from exercise gradually, slowly decelerating over about a half mile after a race and then undergoing a long walk. For Seabiscuit, this meant that after each workout he was covered in a blanket and hot-walked for about a half an hour until he was cool and dry. Then he was given a warm bath, dried, and led back into his stall, where his legs were painted in liniment and wrapped in protective bandages. He had lunch at 11, hay snacks all afternoon, dinner at 5. After that, the horse went to sleep, with his groom, Ollie, on a pallet in the stall with him. Seabiscuit fell into the schedule completely. Rain or shine, Smith was there to check on him at about 8 every night before turning in. Smith gave Seabiscuit time to learn to trust him in Pollard. Seabiscuit learned. When he heard Pollard's deep voice coming down the shed row, he would poke his head over the half-door to greet him. When Pollard, who called the horse Pops, sat outside the stall, reading the paper while Seabiscuit was cooled out, the horse would tug his hot walker off course to snuffle his jockey's hands. When Smith let him out of the stall, he didn't even need a lead rope. The horse would follow his trainer wherever he went, nuzzling his pockets. Smith spoke to the horse in nearly inaudible tones, calling him son, and touching him lightly when he needed him to turn. Seabiscuit understood him and always did as asked. In moments of uncertainty, the horse would pause and look for Smith. When he found his trainer, the horse would relax. Smith taught him that he could trust his trainer and rider, and this became the foundation for the trials the three would share over the next 5 years. Smith let horses get confidence in him, remembered Keith Stuckey, one of the horse's exercise riders. He was the best horseman I've ever seen. With long, careful schooling, Seabiscuit began to figure things out. Once he was no longer being coerced, his instincts bubbled back to the surface. His innate love of running returned. Pollard used the whip not as an implement of force, but as a signal. One glancing swat on the rump at the eighth pole, another a few feet from home, a cue that it was time to hustle. Seabiscuit began to wait for it and respond with lightning quickness. "So long as you treat him like a gentleman," said Pollard, "he'll run his heart out for you." Though the horse was still goofing off and pulling tricks in his workouts, his speed was excellent. After 2 weeks, Smith was ready to send him to the races. Howard agreed. In late August, they tried him in a good stakes race in Detroit. He had the bad luck of drawing into an event that featured the best filly in the country, Myrtlewood. Green to the core, Seabiscuit was all over the track, streaking out with the early leaders as they tried to keep up with Myrtlewood. On the backstretch, he was going along smoothly when, without warning, he threw his forelegs forward and propped, decelerating rapidly and dropping back through the field. Ahead of him, Myrtlewood drove to an insurmountable lead, with local star Professor Paul rallying in vain to catch her. Seabiscuit's temperamental outburst had left him hopelessly beaten. But as Pollard angled him into the stretch and asked him to get his mind back on running, Smith witnessed something he would never forget. Seabiscuit began to rip over the track, cutting into Myrtlewood's lead even as she flew through fractions faster than any ever run at the Detroit fairgrounds. He was much too late to overtake the filly or Professor Paul, but his rally carried him to fourth place, just 4 lengths behind Myrtlewood, who had broken the track record. Even more encouraging, in the home stretch, Seabiscuit's ears were up, a signal that the horse was running within himself. "He showed me 2 great qualifications that day," Smith remembered later. "He showed me speed, and he showed me courage. He was in trouble, and the way he pricked his ears, I knew if I could get the true speed out of him, I would have a champion." Pollard knew it, too. Leaping off of Seabiscuit's back, he ran over to Howard. "Mr. Howard," he sang out, "that horse can win the Santa Anita." Howard laughed. In his next start, on September 2nd, in the Romer Handicap, Seabiscuit had nothing but bad luck. He took the early lead, then swung very wide on the far turn, falling behind into fourth. Pollard tried to rally him, but he was blocked by traffic until deep in the stretch, when he shook loose and flew up, almost catching Professor Paul for the win. Smith was pleased. The horse, he thought, was ready for sterner stuff. On September 7th, Smith led Seabiscuit out for the governor's handicap. The race had no national importance, but in Detroit, it was the big event of the racing season. Seabiscuit was sent off at long odds for good reason. Also entered in the race were Professor Paul and Asukar, George Wolfe's Santa Anita handicap winner, under a new rider and not quite his old self. 28,000 fans, the biggest throng in Michigan racing history, showed up to see it. Among them, Charles and Marcella Howard. They were treated to a spellbinder. Just after the start, Pollard tucked Seabiscuit in behind early leader Biography, who cut a brisk pace. Around the first turn and down the long backstretch, Pollard held Seabiscuit just behind Biography. Leaning into the far turn, Pollard saw a hole along the rail. He threaded Seabiscuit through, and in a few strides he had seized the lead. As Biography accelerated to stay with him, Professor Paul swept up on the grandstand side. In the center of the track, Asukar began to uncurl his long legs and accelerate, grinding away at the lead. In that position, the four horses bent around the turn and hit the home stretch. Pollard, in the lingo of jockeys, asked Seabiscuit the question. Seabiscuit, for the first time in his life, answered. Pollard dropped his belly down in the saddle and rode as hard as he could. The quartet of horses blazed down the stretch at a terrific clip, with Seabiscuit a half length in front. Biography was the first to crack. Professor Paul, carrying just 99 pounds, 10 fewer than Seabiscuit, was skipping along under the light load, inching in on the lead, while Asukar, on the far outside, was driving at them. In mid-stretch, Professor Paul's blinkered head was at Pollard's hip, with Asukar just behind them. A few feet later, Professor Paul was past Pollard's elbow and still gaining. Then Asukar gave way. It was down to Seabiscuit and Professor Paul. The latter was cutting the lead down with every lunge. With the crowd on its feet, Pollard spread himself flat over Seabiscuit's withers, reins clutched in his left hand, right hand pressed flat to Seabiscuit's neck, head turned and eyes fixed on Professor Paul's broad blaze. A few feet from the wire, Professor Paul reached Seabiscuit's throat. He was too late. Seabiscuit had won. Red Pollard had just won his fourth stakes race in 11 long years in the saddle. He was radiant. He galloped Seabiscuit out to the cheers from the crowd, then turned him back toward the grandstand. Beneath him, Seabiscuit bounced along with his tail fanned out high in the air. He played with the bit and wagged an ear at the photographers who stood by the rail, snapping his picture for the morning papers. Pollard steered him back to the winner's stand, leapt off, and ran to Howard, who beamed like a schoolboy. It was only a good stakes race at a minor league track, but it might as well have been the 100-grander. The ceremonies began. On the winner's stand, which was swathed in a huge American flag and crammed with suited dignitaries, Marcella smiled demurely for the lieutenant governor, who extended a huge silver loving cup. Pollard, his skull cap off, his hair dark with sweat, and his head tilted so his good eye focused on the camera, stood behind her, dwarfed by the cup. Smith, grim and spectral, stood alongside him. His mouth was set in its habitual glower, the corners bent downward in perfect convexity, and his ashen head blended seamlessly into the white clouds overhead. Howard, giddy and grinning, was nearly crowded right off the stand. The photo opportunity over, they smoothed the new blanket, emblazoned with the words, "Governor's Handicap Detroit," over Seabiscuit's back, and Howard held Seabiscuit's nose in his hands as a new set of photographs was snapped. Smith stood with them, ignoring the popping flashbulbs to let his eyes comb over his horse. Seabiscuit stood square under his head-to-toe blanket, posed in the stance of the conqueror, head high, ears pricked, eyes roaming the horizon, nostrils flexing with each breath, jaw rolling the bit around with cool confidence. He was a new horse. In the 50th start of his life, Seabiscuit finally understood the game. Smith and Pollard had unearthed in him, in Smith's words, more natural inclination to run than any horse I have ever seen. Behind his frown, Smith was pleased. The colt was transformed. In the barn, he became a disarmingly affectionate glutton. As gentlemanly a horse, marveled Smith, as I ever handled. On the track, once the forum for rebellion, he displayed blistering speed and bulldog tenacity. Smith wasn't ready to put the screws to him just yet. He was beginning to think that Pollard was right about the horse's chances and the Santa Anita handicap. The prospect of running Seabiscuit in the 100 grander and in similar races gave Smith a new issue to consider. Weight. For racetracks, survival depends upon attracting bettors. For bettors, the least attractive race is one in which the favorites finish in the top positions, producing low payoffs for winning bets. To make races more competitive, tracks schedule handicap races, in which a racing secretary, also called a track handicapper, assigns more accomplished horses higher weights, or imposts, than less accomplished horses. This gives long shots a better chance, and thus encourages more wagering. Not all races are handicaps. In the Triple Crown, for example, all male horses carry 126 pounds, but most top races for older horses, including the Santa Anita Handicap, are handicaps. Though Seabiscuit was now amply good enough for the Triple Crown, and probably would have swept it, he had missed his chance. The series is only open to 3-year-olds, and he was about to turn 4. Smith was aiming him for the handicap division in the 100 grander. The imposts for the big race were not yet assigned, and Smith wanted to keep his horse's talent a secret for as long as he could, so that the racing secretary would assign him low weights. Smith kept the horse in the small pond of Detroit, where Seabiscuit followed the governor's handicap win with an impressive score in the Hendry handicap. Smith then shipped him down to Cincinnati's River Downs, where the horse narrowly missed winning 2 more minor stakes. It was at Cincinnati that Seabiscuit's handlers first realized how fanatically competitive the horse was. Those unfamiliar with horses might scoff at the notion of equine pride as a silly anthropomorphism, but the behavior is unmistakable. Those who make their lives among horses see it every day. Horses who lose their riders during races almost always try to win anyway, charging to the lead and sometimes bucking with pleasure as they pass the last opponent. Weanling herds stampede around their paddocks several times a day, running all out to beat one another. Even old stallions, decades away from the track, still duel with one another up and down the fences of breeding farms. As George Wolfe noted, losers show clear signs of dejection and frustration, even shame. Winners prick their ears and swagger. "You don't have to tell good horses when they win or lose," he said. "They know. I guess they come by it kinda natural." Humans aren't the only creatures to seek mastery and rebel at being mastered. The fire that had kept Seabiscuit frustrated and unruly now fueled a bounding will to win. It first surfaced in the midst of a scorching workout alongside Howard's excellent sprinter, Exhibit. Seabiscuit had him beaten, but instead of pulling away, he eased himself up and galloped alongside, going just fast enough to keep Exhibit a notch behind. Exhibit tried his hardest, but Seabiscuit kept adjusting his speed to maintain the short advantage. He appeared to be taunting Exhibit. The two kept it up for a few furlongs before Exhibit abruptly pulled himself up. From that day forward, he refused to work with Seabiscuit. The scene would be reenacted countless times on the racetrack in the next few years, and it would become Seabiscuit's trademark. The horse seemed to take sadistic pleasure in harassing and humiliating his rivals, slowing down to mock them as he passed, snorting in their faces, and pulling up when in front so other horses could draw alongside, then dashing their hopes with a killing burst of speed. Where other horses relied solely on speed to win, Seabiscuit used intimidation. Finding workmates was immediately problematic. One by one, Seabiscuit disposed of the Howard horses in morning workouts, merrily abusing them as he ran. Horses all over the barn became his mortal enemies. Others were heartbroken. Seabiscuit could suck the joy out of any good racehorse's career. A typical example was a fine Argentine import named Sabueso. He managed to beat Seabiscuit in a short blowout one morning and returned to the barn cocky and full of himself. Pollard vowed revenge. In another meeting a short while later, he boasted, "I poured Seabiscuit at him." Seabiscuit humiliated Sabueso. Sabueso refused to eat and didn't sleep for several days. "We had a terrible time straightening him out," Pollard remembered. He sulked and pouted as if to say, "I wish I was back in the Argentine." Smith finally resorted to convincing Sabueso that Seabiscuit had left the string. He housed the two horses as far apart as possible, and whenever Seabiscuit was led down Sabueso's shed row, Pollard or Smith would shut the stall doors so Sabueso wouldn't see him. "I guess the Argentine must think the big horse has gone away," said Pollard. "At any rate, he's all right now. A good horse, too. A little chunk of granite. But make no mistakes, he ain't no Seabiscuit." Seabiscuit's psychological warfare raised more problems than simple wounded pride. If he became too absorbed in rubbing a particular horse's nose in his defeat, he risked being unable to regain his momentum when the closers came after him. Fortunately, though taunting was one of Seabiscuit's greatest pleasures, once he was challenged, the games ended. In a fight, he was all business. As Smith watched him in racing combat, images from his Mustang days assembled in his head. "Did you ever see two stallions fight?" he would later ask. "They look about evenly matched. Most times they are. But one of them has that last reserve of courage and energy which licks the other. Seabiscuit has it." After the performance against Exhibit, Smith thought Seabiscuit was ready to move up a notch. The upstart West had the new Santa Anita handicap, but the East, seat of racing's elite governing bodies and home to all of America's venerable old races and stables, had prestige. In October 1936, Seabiscuit climbed down from a rail car and stepped onto Empire City Racetrack in New York. He was not yet good enough to shoot for the East's great races, so Smith entered him in the Scarsdale Handicap, a mid-level stakes race. Few spectators cared that Seabiscuit, the second longest shot on the board, was in the field. The horse needed just a minute and 44 seconds to change their minds. Fighting his way through one of the wildest contests of the season, Pollard swung Seabiscuit clear of a set of chain reaction collisions on the far turn, circled the field, and sent his mount running in a frantic effort to catch the leaders. In a hub-scraping finish, Seabiscuit dropped his head and won by inches. The finish photo captured the scene. A dense cluster of horses stretched out for the wire, ears flat and lips peeled back in extreme effort. Ahead of them all, ears tipped forward with a jaunty expression, was Seabiscuit's heavy, homely head. Easy. 1 week later, Howard met with Smith. "Let's head for California," he said. "A little wind off San Francisco Bay would do us good." Smith agreed, thinking Seabiscuit could use a rest. The trick was getting the horse there. In the 1930s, long-distance horse shipping could only be done via rail car. A cross-country journey was a harrowing ordeal, 5 days of clanging, rocking, and bumping in a confined space. Train travel was so exhausting and upsetting to most thoroughbreds that few could be taken outside their region. With Seabiscuit, Smith had reason to worry. Back at Saratoga, when he caught sight of the train to Detroit, the colt had panicked so badly that sweat had streamed from his belly. While the other Howard horses filed onto standard horse-class cars, Seabiscuit had earned himself a luxury berth, a full end of a specially modified private Pullman rail car. Half of the car was knee-deep in straw, half was left unbedded so he could stretch his legs. Smith watched to see how Seabiscuit would behave. The horse stepped in and lay down. He would sleep during most of the journey. Smith climbed into the rear car, coming forward at each stop to check on his horse. They were retracing Charles Howard's youthful journey 30 years later. "We're coming back," the old bicycle man told his friends. And when we do, hang on to your hats. Chapter 8 15 Strides. The train sighed into Tanforan on a cool Wednesday morning in November 1936. Seabiscuit clopped onto the unloading ramp and paused halfway down, looking over his new home state. There wasn't much to see. The California sunlight had the pewter cast of a declining season. One or two stable hands crisscrossed the tamped-down earth before the siding. Horses murmured over the grounds. A couple of reporters stood around, looking indifferently at Howard's new horse. They knew that the colt was aiming for the February 27th Santa Anita handicap, but he hadn't done enough to merit serious consideration. Their thoughts were occupied by weightier names: world record holder Indian Broom, Speed Demon Special Agent, and above them all, the magnificent Rosemont, King of the East, and conqueror of 1935 Triple Crown winner Omaha. Eastern horses rarely came to the West in those days, but the size of the purse had brought Rosemont over the Rockies. With Rosemont in the race, no one had any reason to believe that the horse Tom Smith was leading down the platform would be anything more than an also-ran. The reporters jotted down a word or two on Seabiscuit's arrival and moved off. Smith settled the horse in a comfortable stall and retired to his own little room right above it. Smith liked the anonymity. The New York trip had told him that he had a very good horse in his barn, and until the weights were assigned for the 100-grander, he intended to keep him hidden. So the trainer tucked Seabiscuit away on the Tanforan backstretch. He didn't even let his stable hands know how good he thought the horse was. Quietly, slowly, he schooled the horse, fed him well, built his trust. Seabiscuit's ribs filled out. He had put on 200 pounds in the 3 months since he had joined Smith, and his manners had improved. When he came out on the track, he bounced up and down in eagerness to get going. Smith knew Seabiscuit was improving rapidly, but when he sent him out for workouts before the track clockers, he gave him only easy gallops that veiled his speed. No one took much notice of him. One afternoon, when the track was deserted, Smith snuck him out. Smith and Pollard had stripped away the temperamental barriers. It was time to see how fast the colt could go. Smith loaded weight onto his back, boosted an exercise rider aboard, and turned him loose. He watched as Seabiscuit's body flattened down, his speed building, humming over the rail. Smith ticked off the seconds in his head. Something is happening. Lacking competition, racehorses and workouts rarely approach the speeds they achieve in races. But Smith had never seen a horse, any horse, flash this kind of speed, not in a workout, not in a race. Perhaps Smith thought his eyes were failing him, the clock in his head winding out of time. Coming up, a mile to go. He pulled his stopwatch out and pumped the trigger as the horse ripped past the marker. Seabiscuit kept rolling, faster and faster, covering more than 50 feet per second. His trainer watched intently, the surprise of it pushing up through him. Seabiscuit's speed was not flagging. A thought drummed in Smith's mind. He's burning the top right off the racetrack. Seabiscuit banked into the turn. There was a supple geometry to his arc, a fish bending through a current. Where virtually all horses decelerate and often drift out as they try to negotiate corners, Seabiscuit was capable of holding a tight line while accelerating dramatically. No horse has ever run a turn like this one. When the colt flashed under the wire, Smith looked down at his hand. Seabiscuit had worked a mile in 1:36. The track record was 1:38. At that speed, Seabiscuit would have trounced the track record holder by more than a dozen lengths. Tom Smith was wide awake. In 60 years lived alongside thousands of horses, he had never seen anything like this. It was no fluke. In another clandestine workout not long after, the colt would tie a 30-year-old world record for 7/8 of a mile, running it in 1:22. Smith took Seabiscuit back to the barn, his secret seething in his head. For the first time, he grasped the awesome responsibility that lay in his hands. The old cowpuncher was scared to death. Smith wasn't about to let anyone know what he'd seen in that workout. Not yet. The weights weren't out for the 100 grander. He would keep Seabiscuit in San Francisco, where he could work in peace until he was ready for Santa Anita. Howard wanted to show his colt off to his hometown anyway. On November 28, 1936, after nearly a month of legging up at Tanforan, Seabiscuit was trucked 10 miles down the pike to run in Bay Meadows' mile-long Bay Bridge handicap. The field was the best the track had to offer, including Velociter, the former track record holder for the race's mile distance, and the terrific mare Uppermost, the only horse to better Velociter's time. Though his two main rivals had established themselves over the Bay Meadows course, Seabiscuit, by virtue of his Scarsdale handicap win, was given the high weight of 116 pounds, 2 more than Uppermost and 9 more than Velociter. Seabiscuit, a little stir-crazy after a full month on the sidelines, pushed off so hard at the starting bell's ring that he shoveled a big hunk of ground right out from under his hind hooves, dropping nearly to his knees. At the same moment, he was bumped hard by the horse to his left. Pollard somehow managed to stay aboard while his colt regained his footing. By then, the field was 6 lengths up the track. Starting his race all alone, Pollard tried to turn the incident to his advantage, cutting into the rail for a ground-saving trip while far ahead of him, Velociter and Uppermost cruised to the lead. Pollard unleashed Seabiscuit's rally immediately, rushing up behind the field in hopes of finding an avenue through the pack. As the first turn approached, the horses farther out from the rail hustled inward and cut Seabiscuit off. With nowhere to go, Pollard waited. They pulled toward the back stretch, and Pollard saw a narrow hole opened between horses and tried to send Seabiscuit through it. He didn't make it, and had to snatch up the reins and yank Seabiscuit back to prevent him from clipping the heels of the horses coming together in front of him. Trapped again, Pollard waited until the field straightened out. A hole opened. Pollard told Seabiscuit to take it, and the horse darted in. Seabiscuit shot through the pack, swung out, and drew ahead of Uppermost, claiming second on the outside. Only front-running Velociter remained to be caught. Tugging his right rein, Pollard fanned his colt out and hung on as Seabiscuit gunned Velociter down. All alone again, but this time in front, Pollard leaned back and slowed Seabiscuit for the last 50 yards. They cantered down the lane and hit the wire, winners by 5 lengths. A thrill went through the crowd. Seabiscuit had equaled his Tanforan workout time of 1:36 for the mile, officially breaking the track record. 2 clockers who had started their watches when Seabiscuit actually left the gate stared at their watch hands in disbelief. They had caught Seabiscuit running the 5th fastest mile ever run, just 3/5 of a second off the world record. Back at the barn, the stable hands were shocked. They had no idea that the horse was so fast. Only Smith was unsurprised, but he was not happy that the news was out. On Sunday, December 12th, Team Seabiscuit reassembled in the Bay Meadows paddock for the 1 3/16 World's Fair Handicap, the crowning stakes race of the track meeting. The field, including 2 major stakes winners, was the most formidable Seabiscuit had ever faced. Just after Pollard swung aboard, a paddock official waved him back so another horse could precede him in the post parade. Howard yelled across the paddock to the horse's owner, "This is your last chance to be in front." The crowd gave Howard a hearty round of applause. Determined not to be left behind as they had been in the Bay Bridge handicap, Pollard shot Seabiscuit from the starting gate and sent him blowing past the field. Seabiscuit streaked out to a 12-length lead. The panicked jockeys behind him launched frantic rallies to catch him, but they could only cut the lead down to 8 lengths. To wild cheering, Seabiscuit jogged down the home stretch all by himself. Pollard, laughing as he stood in the stirrups and leaned his full weight against the reins, did just about everything he could to slow Seabiscuit down. He wasn't much of a match for his colt, who tugged away at the bridle, begging to run. When they returned to the scales, Seabiscuit wasn't even breathing hard. He had eclipsed another track record, running less than a second off the world record. His time was so fast that in the following year, no horse at Bay Meadows would come within 3 seconds of it. Pollard suddenly found himself in a sea of reporters. If he met the same field again, he sang out, he'd have time to ride Seabiscuit right off the track, canter him down to San Mateo for some Christmas shopping, swing by the post office for their fan mail, and still trot back in time to win the race. The Bay Meadows operators got the point. Seabiscuit was far too good for anything at their track. The message was underscored when the West Coast's most prominent future book wagering operator, who was based in San Francisco, rated Seabiscuit above Rosemont for the 100-grander. Hoping to keep Seabiscuit around for another race, the Bay Meadows racing secretary made an emergency trip out of town, hoping to scare up some of the handicap favorites to face him at Bay Meadows. Rosemont and the other big boys weren't coming. Seabiscuit was going to have to go get them. On December 18th, Seabiscuit stepped onto the russet soil of Santa Anita for the first time. In Barn 38, Smith kicked down the wall between two stalls to create a palatial home for Seabiscuit and Pumpkin. The stable boys dubbed it the Kaiser Suite. The locals at Santa Anita and the press outside the Bay Area greeted the raving headlines from San Francisco with incredulity. A prominent Eastern handicapper called him the most overrated horse in California. The phrase, "Who did he beat?" appeared over and over in the press. "It is difficult to give him a rating above a $5,000 plater," wrote one journalist, using the synonym for claimer. Seabiscuit was a horse who had to be seen to be believed. Trouble dogged him from the moment he was vanned into Santa Anita. Smith had initially planned on running him Christmas Day, but the trainer thought the horse seemed slightly weary and decided to back off for a while. He found a replacement race in the New Year's Stakes, but the track came up muddy. Smith didn't want to risk Seabiscuit's soundness by running on a slippery track, so he scratched him and moved his scheduled Santa Anita debut to January 16, 1937. On the appointed day, an ominous hive of an inch or so square popped up on the colt's coat. Smith withdrew him again. One hive became two, then three, then an army of angry lumps. Driven mad by itching, Seabiscuit began to lose his newfound calm. Unable to train, he began pacing in the stall again. Smith tried every remedy he knew, but the rash kept marching onward. Finally, after more than a week, the rash began to retreat. "Don't tell me about bad breaks," Howard grumbled. "Seabiscuit certainly gets them." The long layoff from racing, culminating in a week stuck itching in the barn, took its toll. Seabiscuit, already inclined toward portliness, was turning into 1,000 pounds of flab. Smith looked the horse over and frowned. "Butterball," he called him. Idleness wasn't the only reason for the added weight. Seabiscuit's groom, Ollie, had been feeding the horse enough rations to fatten up an elephant. Smith had asked him to limit the horse to dry mash, but Ollie had begun sneaking in warm oat mash snacks when he thought Smith wasn't looking. Smith considered firing Ollie, but the horse was so enamored of the groom that Smith decided otherwise. It was the beginning of a chronic problem for Seabiscuit, who loved eating so much that he often followed up his regular meals by consuming his own bedding. Burning the flab off was going to be difficult. Smith was concerned that he'd have to work the horse to death to get the weight off. To get as much weight off as he could with each workout, he took a cue from the jockey's room and began zipping the horse into rubber-lined sweating hoods during the gallops, then wrapping him in hot blankets afterward. He strapped him into a muzzle to stop his snacking. But the biggest problem was Ollie. The groom simply wouldn't do as asked. Smith appealed to the highest court, Marcella Howard. She was the kind of woman who had a certain unspoken authority. She never had to raise her voice. She had a certain expression that communicated things well enough. Smith had seen it himself. She had once come into his barn and discovered jockey Farrell Jones lying on a cot in the cold, drafty tack room, desperately ill with an infection. Smith, who never missed a pimple on a horse but tended to be oblivious to the plight of his fellow man, hadn't taken the slightest notice of the boy and whatever ominous hacking noises must have been coming from the tack room. Marcella was appalled. She fired that look around. Farrell got his medicine and blankets, and everyone felt ashamed of themselves. No one ever forgot it. Smith asked Marcella to see what she could do about Seabiscuit's clandestine munching. Marcella called on Ollie, and they had a talk. The gift snacks disappeared. Smith started conditioning his horse all over again. By the time Smith was able to get Seabiscuit in racing shape, 2 months had passed since the World's Fair Handicap. It was already the second week of February. The Santa Anita Handicap was a little more than 2 weeks away, and Seabiscuit was far behind in his preparation. If Smith could get the horse into a race on the weekend of February 9th, he would have enough time to run him once more before the 100-grander. The only suitable race that weekend was the 7-furlong Huntington Beach Handicap, in which Rosemont was set to run. Smith had avoided Rosemont earlier in the season, not because he feared Seabiscuit would lose, but because he feared his horse would win, prompting the racing secretary to assign him heavy weight for the 100-grander. That problem no longer existed. Weights had finally been posted. Seabiscuit would carry 114 pounds, probably not as few as Smith had hoped for, but no backbreaker either. On February 9th, Smith sent his horse out for the Huntington. Without any urging from Pollard, Seabiscuit shot from the gate as he had in the World's Fair, but this time there was a horse to go with him, Cloud D'Or. Pollard clucked once in Seabiscuit's ear, and his colt hooked up with his rival on a dizzying pace, with Seabiscuit down on the deep, slow rail and Cloud D'Or on the outside. After half a mile, they were 2 2/5 seconds below the track record. At 3/4 of a mile, they were just 1 second off the world record. They left the field far behind them, never to catch up. In the home stretch, with a 1/16 of a mile to go, Seabiscuit had had enough fooling around and abruptly burst away from Cloud D'Or. Once safely in the lead, Pollard slowed him down, and Seabiscuit galloped in ahead by 4.5 lengths. Rosemont labored in far behind. After they passed the wire, Pollard let Seabiscuit keep running to get more of a workout from the race. The horse galloped until he had completed 1 mile in 1:36. More than 1 second faster than any horse would run that distance at Santa Anita in the entire year. Again, Seabiscuit wasn't even breathing hard in the winner's circle. "Heck, I've never let Seabiscuit out yet," Pollard boasted after the race. "You'll really see Seabiscuit do some running when I cut him loose in the big race." Smith knew he had the best horse in America. Horsemen in the East didn't know it yet. In the Eastern race books, the horse was still a long shot for the 100-grander. Seabiscuit's final prep race, the San Antonio Handicap, seemed to confirm the Easterner's wisdom. Hung out in post position 11 positions out from the rail, Seabiscuit was bumped at the break, dropped back to 14th, then drifted extremely wide down the back stretch as Rosemont cruised ahead of him. Seabiscuit ran up on the heels of a group of horses and was forced to check sharply, then ran hopelessly wide again on the final turn. Finally loose in the stretch, Seabiscuit cut Rosemont's 8-length lead in half but couldn't catch him, finishing 5th. Rosemont won. Quiet trepidation settled over the Howard barn in the week before the Santa Anita Handicap. Late in the week, a long, soaking shower doused the racing oval. When the rain stopped, asphalt baking machines droned over the course, licking flames over the surface to dry the soil. Rosemont emerged from the barn 3 days before the race and scorched the track in his final workout. Reporters waited for Smith to give his horse a similar workout, but they never saw Seabiscuit doing anything more than stretching his legs. Rumors swirled around the track that Seabiscuit was lame. Rosemont's stock rose, Seabiscuit's dropped. Smith had fooled them. At 3 o'clock one morning shortly before the race, he led Seabiscuit out to the track and gave him one last workout in peace and isolation. The horse ran beautifully. On February 27, 1937, Charles and Marcella Howard arrived at Santa Anita to watch their pride and joy go for the 100 grander. They were giddy with anticipation. "If Seabiscuit loses," mused a friend, "Mrs. Howard is going to be so heartbroken that I'll have to carry her out. If he wins, Charlie'll be so excited that I'll have to carry him." Howard couldn't keep still. He trotted up to the press box and made the wildly popular announcement that if his horse won, he'd send up a barrel of champagne for the reporters. He went down to the betting area, and seeing that the line was too long to wait, he grabbed a better and jammed 5 $1,000 bills into his hand. "Put it all on Seabiscuit's nose, please," he told the bewildered wagerer before trotting off again. At a little past 4 p.m., Pollard and Seabiscuit parted from Smith at the paddock gate and walked out onto the track for the Santa Anita Handicap. A record crowd of 60,000 fans had come to see 18 horses try for the richest purse in the world. Millions more listened on radio. As Pollard felt Seabiscuit's hooves sink into the russet soil, he had reason to worry. The baking machines had not completely dried the surface. Rain and dirt had blended into a heavy goo along the rail. Breaking from the three-post, Seabiscuit would be right down in it. Far behind him in the post parade, jockey Harry Richards was contemplating a different set of obstacles for Rosemont. He had drawn the 17th post position. He was going to have the luxury of a hard, fast track, but his problem would be traffic. As a late runner, Rosemont would have to pick his way through the cluttered field. The two jockeys virtually bookended the field as they moved to the post. Pollard feared nothing but Richards and Rosemont. Richards feared nothing but Pollard and Seabiscuit. The two horses stood motionless while the field was loaded around them. At the sound of the bell, Seabiscuit bounded forward. To his outside, a crowd of horses rushed inward to gain optimal position. The field doubled over on itself, and the hinge was Seabiscuit, who was pinched back to ninth. In a cloud of horses, Pollard spotted Daylight 5 feet or so off the rail. He banked Seabiscuit out into it, holding him out of the deep part of the track. He slipped up to fourth position, just off of front-running Special Agent. On the first turn, Seabiscuit was crowded back down to the rail. As the field straightened into the backstretch, Pollard found another avenue and eased him outward again to firmer ground. Ahead, Special Agent was setting a suicidal pace, but Pollard sensed how fast it was and was not going to be lured into it. He sat back and waited. Behind him, Rosemont was tugging along toward the back of the field, waiting for the speed horses to crumble. With a half mile to go, Pollard positioned Seabiscuit in the clear and readied for his move. Behind him, Richards sensed that the moment had come to shoot for Seabiscuit. He began threading Rosemont through the field, cutting in and out, picking off horses one by one, talking in his horse's ear as clumps of dirt cracked into his face. His luck was holding. Every hole toward which he guided his horse held open just long enough for him to gallop through. On the far turn, he reached Seabiscuit's heels and began looking for a way around him. Ahead of him, Pollard crouched and watched Special Agent's churning hindquarters, waiting for him to fold. At the top of the stretch, Special Agent faltered. Pollard pulled Seabiscuit's nose to the outside and slapped him on the rump. Seabiscuit pounced. Richard saw him go and gunned Rosemont through the hole after him, but Seabiscuit had stolen a 3-length advantage. Special Agent gave way grudgingly along the inside as Indian Broom rallied up the outside, not quite quick enough to keep up. Lengthening stride for the long run to the wire, Seabiscuit was alone on the lead in the dry, hard center of the track. Pollard had delivered a masterpiece of reinsmanship, avoiding the traps and saving ground while minimizing his run along the boggy rail. He had won the tactical battle with Richards. He was coming into the home stretch of the richest race in the world with a strong horse beneath him. Behind them were 17 of the best horses in the nation. To the left and right, 60,000 voices roared. Ahead was nothing but a long strip of red soil. The rest of the field peeled away, scattered across 32 lengths of track behind them. It was down to Rosemont and Seabiscuit. Seabiscuit was moving fastest. He charged down the stretch in front with Pollard up over his neck, moving with him, driving him on. Rosemont was obscured behind him. He was gaining only by increments. Seabiscuit sailed through mid-stretch,